International Home Decor. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Illinois State Geological Survey Centennial Lecture Series. At 7 p.m. on Wednesday, April 26th, in the second floor ballroom of the Illini Union, 1401 West Grain Street, Urbana, the Geological Survey is presenting a public lecture titled, A Crack in the Edge of the World, America and the Great California Earthquake of 1906, by noted author and geologist Simon Winchester.
This is Focus 580, the second hour of the program. We're live here in this hour. I'm glad to have you here. My name is David Inge, by the way. I'm the host. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. Have you ever wondered why people give the reasons they do for what they have done? Well, certainly our guest for this hour, sociologist Charles Tilly, had wondered. And as a result of thinking about that very question, we have a book that we'll be talking about in this hour of Focus 580, a book that he's authored. The title of the book is Why? What Happens When People Give Reasons and Why? It has been newly published by the Princeton University Press. Our guest, Charles Tilly, is professor of social science at Columbia University. In his work, he focuses on large-scale social change and its relationship to contentious politics, and has written a number of books. His most recent, The Politics of Collective Violence, Contention and Democracy in Europe, 1650 to 2000. He's joining us this morning by telephone to talk a little bit about his book and about this very question, why people give the reasons they do for what they've done. As we talk, as always, questions are welcome from people who are listening. The only things we ask of callers, those who call into the show, is that people try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. So you're also welcome to call, though, no matter what. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have the toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. At any point, if you have questions, you're welcome to call. Professor Tilly, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
I'm glad to be on the line.
Well, let me ask you to begin, because as I mentioned, and it's my understanding that the kind of things generally you study are politics on a very large scale, things like revolutions, for example. This subject is a little bit smaller in scale and has a lot to do with individual relations, that is, in the relations between one person and another. What was it that got you so interested in this that you ended up thinking about it enough that you wrote a book?
Well, I suppose three things. First is that if you study politics on the large scale, you eventually start thinking about what people are doing on the small scale, how they justify what they're doing, how they make their choices, and so forth. Second, it seemed to me that people who did talk about interpersonal relations often missed an obvious point of what was happening when they justified their actions or when they explained what had happened. And the third was, well, I live in a small-scale world too and couldn't help noticing some interesting patterns in how people give reasons.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm interested in another point that you make, that so much of what goes on in the world, It is the result, to use a metaphor, it is the result of conversation. That is, it's people and their interactions with one another. It's not, even on the grand scale, certainly, it's not the matter of one person or maybe even a few people deciding what's going to happen. Because the other point that you make, and I think it's certainly well taken, is that while we may think the things that happen in the world are the result of intention by somebody, in fact, most of the time, you know what they say about making plans. Most of the time, people rarely do manage to accomplish what it is they plan to do.
Absolutely. Now, what's interesting about many things are interesting about this, but one of the things that's more interesting about the way we give accounts in general is that we do package them as, well, I wanted to do this, and then I tried to do that, and here's what happened. That is, we snap easily into an individual account of what's going on, and I actually think that has something to do with the way we process stories. We'll probably get to that a little bit later, mm-hmm. But that the everyday account, he said, she said, I intended, they wanted, and so forth, just doesn't work very well as an explanation, at least in my life. I rarely accomplish what I set out to do, and I often find that I've accomplished something quite different, maybe something I don't want to happen, lots of unintended consequences, lots of mistakes, and we ought to have a way of talking about social processes, about interpersonal relations, that takes this kind of conversational intervention, this connection with other people, and the way it changes our idea of what we're doing and what we actually accomplish directly into the picture.
Well, let's go and talk a little bit about each of the four categories in which you argue that most of the kinds of reasons, the kind of explanations that people give, most of them fall into one of four categories, although the lines, the dividing lines between the four are not exactly clear. They blur a little bit from one to the other, and they're related, and I think also you make the point that you're not necessarily suggesting that one is somehow better than the other. It's not a matter of they're not hierarchical. It's just that they're different, and that in fact any one of us might well employ one of them, depending on the situation and depending on who it is we're talking to. But you're starting with conventions. So
right.
what are conventions?
Well, conventions are brief accounts that simply locate what you're doing or what you're saying in some kind of a context that the other person, the person who's hearing the reasons, will recognize immediately. In New York City, where I'm talking to you from, you can arrive at a meeting late and you say, oh, the subway was a mess. Now, there's a little bit of explanation in that, but basically it just says, all right, there's a condition we all know about, and it's available as an account of why something happened. Or I might say, I spill coffee on your newspaper, and I say, oh, I'm such a klutz. Now, it's not an explanation in depth, but it's available. Okay, so that's how conventions work. You take a look in a book of etiquette, for example, and it's really surprising what a high proportion of the advice you get is how to provide not a detailed explanation of what you did, but a convention that's suitable for this occasion. I can't come to your party. I'm sorry I forgot. I'm very happy that this is happening, and so forth. This is a convention that you offer rather than a detailed explanation or a really organized justification.
And the nice thing, I suppose, about conventions is that they do dispense with detail. That is, they don't make it necessary for you to tell a long story about what happened. And the other thing that's nice about them is they don't necessarily have to make sense, really. I mean, they don't really provide much of an explanation, because so many of the conventions just sort of rely on your acknowledging that, well, things happen. And,
absolutely.
And they're not and that things happen that are beyond our control, that they just happen. You know how it is. And the other person will probably say, well, yes, I do know how it is. And you go on from there.
Absolutely. You're not doing things so well. And somebody sort of looks at you curiously and you say, well, you know, it's one of those days. That's the convention. You know, it doesn't really explain anything. And it's actually not something you could get away with your spouse most of the time. That is, you say, oh, it's just one of those days. What do you mean it's one of those days? I mean, you've got to tell me a little more about why you're being so incompetent today than that. And that takes us to an important point that's true of all the different kinds of reasons, and that is that the right reason doesn't just depend on the truth or the background or even the general social situation that you're in, it depends on the relationship to the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And so you are actually telling the other person something about the relationship between you. Most of the time, conventions are so they're sort of warm and fuzzy in the sense that they confirm that we all belong to the same community. We know that the New York subway is often a mess. We know that people have bad days and so forth, and that's just part of our shared understanding.
Well, is it the case that most of the time we employ conventions with people with whom our relations are more casual and not so close?
On the average, that's the case, although now and then you will signal to somebody who's pretty close, this is just a bad day, and so forth. And you have somehow worked out an agreement over time that you're not going to talk about it now, although you may hear about your ingrown toenail or whatever else is bugging you on some other occasion. So we do use conventions in close relationships, but on the average, you're much more likely to use a convention with someone, for example, sitting next to you on a bus, or somebody you simply meet casually at a party or something of that kind, than you are to somebody who's a member of your family, a close friend, a close business associate.
Hmm. One wonders why it is we're willing to accept them, given the fact that often there's not, if you look behind them, there's no there. They really don't offer much of an explanation.
But just think of the alternative. What if we had to explain everything?
Hmm.
You know, what if every time something happened, we had to provide a really satisfactory account? First of all, we would spend all of our lives explaining. We would spend an awful lot of time. This kind of a shorthand where you simply provide a convention saves time and energy. As a matter of fact, just try it sometime. Somebody says, "How are you?" And you launch into a detailed discussion of every ailment you felt over the last 3 weeks. You're going to lose your audience pretty fast.
You'll find out really quickly that they really weren't interested, or at least not to that kind of
depth.
I'm
doing fine. We'll do much better than a detailed account of your ailments or how your friends are treating you badly or any number of other things that you might be full of at the moment.
Mm. Our guest, by the way, is Charles Tilley. He's professor of social science at Columbia University. We're talking about his newly published book, Why? That's the title. The subtitle is What Happens When People Give Reasons and Why? And it takes a look at this basic question. Why is it that people give the reasons they do for the things that they have done? Or perhaps in some cases, it's a matter of trying to explain the world what happens.
It is.
And giving some kind of reason, because as I think he points out, one of the things about human beings is that we want to know why things happen. We want explanations for stuff. It's very unsatisfying when things happen and we just have to shrug our shoulders and say, who knows? We don't like that. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's just go on, and I have a caller here. I hope that person won't mind waiting for a minute here, but to go on to the next category, because this seems to be, in a sense, a kind of an extension of the convention, because this is the next step. It's actually going beyond our saying, well, you know, things happen and you know how life is, and to actually telling a little bit more of a story that gives more background, that says, well, I will give you the more detail that perhaps because of the kind of relationship we have, you're entitled to and you're interested in.
You mean the story?
The story, yes.
Well, I think the story is one of the great human inventions, and that somehow, very early in life, maybe it's even wired in, we learn to package our accounts of human affairs in stories. For a long time, people have noticed the general structure of the story. I certainly didn't discover it. But there's this basic structure which says, okay, there are a couple of actors, a couple of people who are doing things, and they're in connection with each other. And there are only a small number of actions, and those actions cause everything else that happens in the story, and it has a beginning and a middle and an end, and it has a unity of time and place. It's a wonderful device because it gets rid of all kinds of complications. As I was saying earlier, life really is full of feedback and unintended consequences and simultaneous effects and so forth. Those disappear from stories. So we get to say, he did that to her, and she was mad. There's a little story, and so forth. Now, it's different from a convention in that it actually has an explanation, however simple, built into it. And if you listen in a public place, in New York, would be on the bus or the subway, most likely, you'll find people giving accounts in story form all the time. And they often have a moral edge to them. That is, they involve saying, well, it was his fault. And the story shows how it was his fault that he didn't take her into account, so forth. The story is terrific because it makes available a structure that people recognize instantly. It's not like somebody was giving you physics. It's something that you can immediately package things into. My 3-year-old grandchildren begin to tell stories, and they know how to use the structure to explain that their big brother took a toy from them and yelled at them, or something like that. They have the story structure available as a way to go to someone else and say, here's what happened. And it's a reason. I did it because he dissed me. I did it because he offered me rewards, or something along that particular line. That's easy to package into a story. It's a highly flexible form. Now, stories also appear on TV. I mean, they're the essence of the telenovela, of the soap opera, of the theater, and so forth. It's not that they only take place in everyday conversation. But when it comes to everyday conversation, giving reasons often takes story form. And as we were saying earlier, it's often with someone you know a little better, that you're a little closer to, where a mere convention won't end the conversation. They actually want to know why something happened.
Well, let's talk with this caller that we have here. I'll bring them into the conversation. This is someone listening in Urbana, and they are on line number one.
Yes. Hello. Good morning. A book that was popular in the 70s called I'm Okay, You're Okay, which sought to characterize very intimate conversations. And intimate situations, by intimate I mean family, you know, context.
Sure.
When somebody says, well, why did you do that? They don't really want to know why. They just want you to stop.
Yes.
And, I was thinking of my small granddaughter, and for a long time my daughter-in-law would say, well, what are you doing?
Yes.
And she'd say, or what is all this about? And she'd point to the picture on the wall and say, that's a camel, you know. When people are discussing something of a family nature, you know, they don't really want to know why you did it, because, yes, they may want to know why, but then they're going to counteract it. And so what they're really saying is, don't do that anymore.
Sure, but they're also giving you a chance to say why you did it. That is, that's the nice thing about the interaction. Of course, sometimes I'll say to someone, why in the world did you do that? And then it's clear that I think it was a stupid stupid or evil thing to do. There's no question about that. So that is a form of interaction.
But, you know,
but in fact,
that.
Now and then someone will reply and say, well, wait a minute, and then give me a story. Say, look, I had to do it. I had to do it because so-and-so is pressuring me. Now, that's less likely from your or my three-year-old grandchildren.
Right.
It's true. But it still happens within families just as it happens outside of families.
Well, in adult interactions, though, it seems to me that when somebody says why,
sure,
they really are saying, stop doing that, it's bugging me.
No, I think that's only one of the occasions, because very often you have a mystery. You know, somebody went out and bought a motorcycle. Why in the world did you buy a motorcycle? When you say why, it's not just saying stop it. You're saying, you owe me something for an explanation. You took our family money without consultation, and you bought a motorcycle. Come on, give me an account of that, and a story will come out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Well, what this does, though, this now actually gets me thinking about the next category of reasons, the codes, and that's how much that often parent-child interaction has to do with dueling codes and stories.
Absolutely.
When you have the situation where you say to the child, what are you doing? Why did you do that? And they're going to try to give you some story. And I think often the response of the parent is to respond with that category with codes that says, well, look, in this house, we have some rules. That's the explanation of, look, we have established ways of doing things, and these are the rules, and they're posted clearly. Or, you know, maybe in those sort of situations where you can say, see on the wall over there? those are the rules that we follow, and that's why we do things the way we do, because the rules say that we do them the way we do.
Absolutely, and of course it happens in families, and the line that parents take is often, look, here's how we do things here. I don't care what Janie's family does. Here's how we do things here. Now, that is, of course, a code statement, and it usually refers to more than one principle. There are a bunch of things that we do here and that set us off from the rest. The same thing is true of a schoolroom. That is, a kid... is not paying attention, in fact, is even falling asleep or something like that. The teacher says, what are you doing, Johnny? And the kid says, well, you know, I wasn't very interested. And the teacher replies with a code and says, you stay interested. We stay interested in this class. And if you don't understand what's going on, you raise your hand. That's a code. Many codes, however, belong to specialists of different kinds. A teacher is a specialist, of course, but specialists in working out and using codes. For example, a lawyer. Lawyers spend a great deal of their time on codes, and, of course, they're sometimes called codes, that is, when they've been written into law. But more generally, lawyers spend a lot of time matching things that happened, not with a story, not really very much about why did they happen, but did they conform to some set of principles that constitute a crime, for example, or that constitute a tort. So there's a pattern matching element. That's true with little Johnny, and it's true inside the household, too, a pattern matching. You're not in the pattern. Here's what the pattern is supposed to be. We can see it even more dramatically when the code maker or code enforcer is a lawyer or a doctor. Everyone who goes to doctors notices, or at least runs into, codes. There's a very interesting pattern that I suppose everybody who's spent a little bit of time in the medical world recognizes, in which a new physician, you've got a medical student or maybe a resident who's learning something about the particular discipline. Let's say the arthritis, the whole body of illnesses called arthritis. And in a first round of code learning, the student learns how to match what patients say and present, what they look like, what their pulse is like, what their blood pressure is, but also what they say in a medical interview with a code made up as the checklist for a medical interview. Aha! There is a symptom. So there's a code for any particular set of ailments that consists of frequent symptoms, and the medical interview uncovers those symptoms. And the student, first learning this, then reports to the supervising physician or the teacher or something like that, well, I noticed this, 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 and this. That leads to the second code, where you match the symptoms with illnesses, with different kinds of sickness, with different kinds of viruses, and so forth. So there's a second code work that goes on all the time in medicine, and say, okay, we've got this set of symptoms. Let's try to figure out what illness this person has. That's code two. And then, having figured out that this is rheumatoid arthritis, for example, then there's a third code matching, which is with a set of treatments. All right, so how do we treat rheumatoid arthritis? In short, physicians learn very early in their careers how to use codes. Now, behind those codes, of course, there's lots of experience in explaining people's getting sick. It's not that they have no stories in them at all. But basically what's going on, especially as someone who's learning to be a doctor, is making second nature the matching of observations with codes. And as a matter of fact, what happens over and over again in medical training is people say, oh, no, you've made the wrong match. You know, you missed these features of the medical interview that tell us we've got a real problem here. There's something wrong with this person's colon, and you're looking at the heart.
We have another caller here. Let's talk with them. And this is line two in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. This is really interesting. I've been looking forward to it since I heard the topic announced. I want to go back to explanatory stories. It seems like there's a couple of different ways people have described how people tell stories. And, for example, one way is we tend to ascribe external factors to explain our behavior, but we ascribe internal factors to explain other people's behaviors. So I see somebody in a line and they're rude, and I think, well, that person's just a jerk. Now, on the other hand, if I snap at somebody, I explain, well, of course I snapped because this person stepped on my foot and they said something mean to me. So we give external factors to explain other people's behavior, external factors to explain our behavior, especially when it's bad, internal factors to explain other people's behaviors, but even when it's good. So why do I give money to charity? Obviously, I'm a good person. Why does that other person give money to charity? Well, they must feel social pressure, or they're trying to look good to the community.
Okay, so you just created a much more interesting theory than you started with, because you just reversed the terms. In what you said is sort of casually, that is, in more distant relationships, we attribute blame to internal states. That person has something wrong with them.
When we're blaming somebody else, right?
And when we're, that's right, when we're describing somebody else. But when we're describing ourselves, well, you say, oh, look, they pushed me, or
right.
Something of that
kind. Or the train was late.
But when we're taking credit, it reverses.
Right.
So I'm, you know, I look good.
Oh, wait, no, it doesn't. What I think I said, or what I tried to say, was when I say give charity, I explain it by saying I'm a good person. That's the internal.
Yeah, but isn't that's right.
Oh, yes,
now you're talking
right.
About yourself.
Yes, you're right.
You're talking about yourself, and you're saying I did it because I'm good. And very often, we make exactly that split. It's a great insight because when we're taking credit, we credit internal states. We don't say, oh, look, my brother-in-law gave me this, and it's not, I mean, we might put on a show of modesty, but most of the time we say, yeah, it took me a long time to learn how to do this. And somebody else says it, oh, you know, his uncle is in the judging committee or something of that mm-hmm. kind. So it has to do with whether we're giving credit or blame.
Well, another way that people talk about explanatory stories or style is with pessimists and optimists. When something bad happens to a pessimist, one of the things that makes them a pessimist is they believe that it's long-term and that it's permanent. When something bad happens to an optimist, then they believe that, well, it's such a short-term and it's temporary.
Yes, in fact, that's how we know that they're pessimists or optimists.
Right, and the opposite happens for good things. Right. So how does this fit into your theory and the way you're describing stories and storytelling and how people explain the world? And I'll go ahead and ring off and listen offline.
What you're concentrating on here is what's the intention or what's the orientation of the person who gives the reason, and that's terribly important. But what I try to say is, you know, it depends on who you're talking to. That is, it depends on who the receiver of reasons is, and the stories you've just offered us, I think, make that point. Because if you think about giving the same kinds of reasons to someone who is close to you and someone you just happen to meet and they're asking why you're holding your knee or something of that kind, you'll realize that you owe a different kind of account to the person who is close. Then that's pretty systematic, and it goes across pessimists and optimists. It goes across people who are explaining good things and bad things. Which reasons make sense depends on who's receiving the reasons, or to be more accurate, on the relationship between the giver and the receiver.
We are past our midpoint here. Let me again just very quickly introduce our guest, Charles Tilley. He's professor of social science at Columbia University, and we are talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, Why? What Happens When People Give Reasons and Why? It's published by the Princeton University Press. Questions are welcome here, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's just talk for a moment about the fourth. We mentioned at the beginning that there were these four categories, and we've right. talked a little bit about convention, stories, codes. There is a fourth one, technical accounts, and this is, I guess, the kind of explanation that you would get, you have a building failure, you ask a structural engineer. They'll give you an explanation. If you have a war, you ask a political scientist, I guess they'll try to give you a technical account. It's a way of, and it's the kind of thing that generally you're going to get from someone who does have some very specific kind of technical expertise in some field who will give you what probably is the most kind of refined cause and effect explanation for why something really happened. They can say, all right, I can tell you why that happened. And assuming that they can follow the technical points, you can say, okay, so yeah, I see the explanation that you're given. It seems that the most highly developed in a sense, it's not just, well, you know, things happen. This is, well, I can tell you why this
sure.
particular thing happened.
But before we get directly into that, let's recognize one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Structural engineers also tell stories. They also use conventions. They also use codes, and they actually spend lots of time on building codes, on the right kind of stresses in metals and so forth. So it's not that if you're a specialist, you talk in technical accounts. But it's true that specialists in one kind of fairly coherent way of organizing knowledge or another commonly talk to each other in technical accounts and sometimes offer the rest of us a technical account. For example, we find biologists, cell biologists, who are communicating with each other about something interesting that they've found under the microscope. They provide shorthands built into technical accounts to each other. And then you get them on National Public Radio, and they have to figure out, well, how am I going to tell people generally, people who are not microbiologists, about my findings? Well, they provide a simplified technical account, but they are still people we look to for technical accounts, or, as I was suggesting when we talked about physicians earlier, you go to your doctor, and you certainly, unless you're a doctor yourself, or maybe someone who worries a great deal and reads medical books and so forth, you don't want the full technical account of the problem you're having, but you do want some. Mm. You want the doctor to give it a name. You want the doctor to say, in general, where that condition came from. And if you probe, you want the doctor to be able to provide more details on the cause and effect, and for that matter, the likely outcome of the treatment that she or he is recommending. So technical accounts matter a lot, and they sometimes do compete with each other. That is, the example you gave is a pretty good one, where a bridge goes down, and you've got structural engineers who will tell you something about the stresses on that bridge from crosswinds or something of that kind. But there are likely to be political scientists who say, well, wait a minute. Yeah, it's true that the stresses brought it down, but did you know who contracted for that? You know what corrupt politicians took money for a cheap job on that bridge? Well, those are both technical accounts, one more sophisticated than the other, maybe, but belonging to a particular discipline.
Mm-hmm. And we might just resort, those of us who are neither, might just resort to conventions and say something like, well, you know, nobody knows how to build out a bridge anymore. They just don't build stuff like they used to.
Well, there's a great author about engineering called Henry Petrosky, who teaches civil engineering at Duke University and has written a series of books about design, mm-hmm. to design as human and others. Petrosky says in one of his books that he had exactly this problem with one of his neighbors. It was a time when a major catwalk failure had occurred, and his neighbor ragged him. He said, you know, don't engineers know how to figure out the stresses on a catwalk in a big hotel? And Petrosky said, well, I simply had to explain to him that there are always unknown limits to the stress. You can't get everything right. It's a very complicated matter. And Petrosky says in his book, well, his neighbor probably went away entirely unconvinced, but thinking that he had scored a point against the arrogant engineers who always think they know better.
Yeah.
And we often have a little bit of that feeling when we run into somebody who gives us a technical account. It's jargon. It's a way of defending their turf. It's just complicated because they enjoy complexity, but the fact is that it's simpler than that if only they were willing to tell us. Well, sometimes it is, but most of the time there are good reasons. We're talking about reasons. There are good reasons for using a technical account. Why? Well, because it allows you, first of all, to speak economically with other people who already know a lot about the phenomena, so you can assume a whole series of cause-effect connections. Second, because in real causal stories, as they come out in technical accounts, there are all kinds of complexities, like effects that take a long time to work. You can't simply represent them as X did Y, and immediately Z happened or something like that, they're incremental in that sense. Or there's feedback, there's simultaneous effects, there are environmental effects, and so on. Technical accounts are full of effects of that kind. And as a matter of fact, those of us who work with technical accounts usually get a lot of our fun out of seeing those complexities and figuring out exactly what the causal path is.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing about all this that interests me the most, I think, is the implications for, going back to this idea that social processes are the result of conversation, the implications for the kind of conversations that we have, particularly about difficult or contentious issues, and how it is we talk about why things happen and how perhaps ultimately that ends up in codes being written. It strikes me that so much of the time, the reason that we have a difficult time talking about difficult things is that we're maybe divided between people who tend to be storytellers and people who tend to be technocrats. that is, people who, you know, the difference, and we see this all the time in, I think we certainly see this all the time in politics, where you have somebody who may be, in fact, more successful because he's a good storyteller, and someone who is less successful because he really wants to give you the technical explanation. And in fact, the technical explanation may be completely correct, and yet we're not always up for that. I think we're more susceptible to a good story than we are to a technical explanation, no matter how good that explanation is.
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, we could take the example of global warming. By now, there are plenty of technical people who are studying and writing about global warming. But global warming is a complex process. You know, it has to do with interactions between things that happen under the sea and at the Earth's surface and up in the ionosphere. There are whole circles of connection that are part of the technical account of global warming. You then get someone who is in politics. They can't cart with them the whole wheelbarrow full of technical accounts. They have to say, you know, your gas guzzlers are putting carbon dioxide emissions into the air, and those are eventually warming the environment. And as a result, the ice caps at the North and South Poles are melting. There's something you might be able to get your teeth into. It's not a technical account. And it misses whole steps in the causal argument, but it's accessible. And then people start shouting at each other because they say, oh, no, wait a minute. Automobiles and trucks are really a very small part of it. In fact, that part of the science is dubious anyway.
Yeah. So that it again, sort of reinforces in my mind this idea that if you're trying to persuade someone of something, that your position on something is the correct one, you may well be able to draw on some kind of technical expertise, but if you can't tell a good story, then that's not going to work. Chances are you will not be able to persuade that person, particularly if they're already holding a point of view that doesn't square with yours.
Well, you know, sometimes that's true. Again, we have to think about your relationship to the technical expert. There are times when the Supreme Court comes down with a ruling and we say, well, look, I don't understand that ruling, but these people and the lawyers that have been arguing before them know the law. And if it's not something that has to do with a hot button issue like abortion, same-sex marriage, something else of the kind, we're like to say, well, all right, it's pretty complicated, but those people probably know their business. We do that all the time with engineers and physicians and lawyers and so forth, and we throw up our hands and we say, well, I guess he knows the law, you know, and I'll take it. People tell me he's a good lawyer and that he has argued a lot of cases of this kind. I guess I'll have to take it on his authority. So sometimes we do that. But I agree that in everyday conversation, in our routine discussions of public issues, deciding whether we ought to be restricting the immigration of Mexicans, whether we ought to have a guest worker program for Mexican immigrants, whether an amnesty would make a lot of sense. There are technical accounts available. There are economists and others analyzing what the effect of migration is on the American labor market and what it does to the wages of American workers and so on. Most of the time, if the person retailing one of those technical accounts cannot put it in story form, he's going to have a very small audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with some other callers. Sean Bain, let's go here to line number one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm an attorney and a retired law professor, and I don't know if you talked about the profession of law in which storytelling and narratives is an inherent aspect of. Whether you're doing complex litigation or complex transactional work or more mundane work, in fact, when you have an expert on the stand, whether it's in a complex matter which requires expert testimony, one of the things you charge the expert with is being able to, quote, look the jury in the eye and speak in terms that can connect with the jury in terms of narratives.
Absolutely.
Or storytelling.
Although... one of the interesting things, if you've been following the whole conversation, you realize that a lot of expert witnesses, I mean, you know this better than I do because you're in the business, but a lot of expert witnesses, what you're trying to get is not an explanation so much as a story about what somebody did. I mean, you see this all the time in medical malpractice. You're asking... Okay, tell me what the standard of practice is for this particular disease or for childbirth or something.
Yeah, what's the standard of care and whether or not the doctor whose conduct is being questioned
deviated
from that standard.
And so what you're doing there is matching it with a code. Now, it's certainly true that if the doctor told you everything he or she knows about practice in that field, the jury would doze off and you'd never make your case. So it has to come down to a relatively small number of points. But very often what's happening in this case is you're saying, all right, did they follow the code or not?
Right.
And if you collect, that is, if you're the attorney for the plaintiff, you're likely to collect by saying, look, here are three things that any competent doctor should have done in this case of choking before the cardiac arrest occurred. This doctor did not do those things. The standard of care is such and such, and this doctor didn't follow the standard of care. It's still true, though, as you're saying, that if what the medical specialist says in these circumstances is a detailed account of exactly how you handle choking victims, you're going to lose your audience.
Yeah, I would imagine that a lot of storytelling is going on by expert witnesses to different juries in the Merck-Vioxx litigation right now.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a great deal of storytelling going on in that occasion. Sure.
Thank you, sir.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay.
Well, let's go to another caller here. We have someone in Chicago, line four. Hello.
Thank you. I guess part of our lack of a response to some of the conditions that are going on in the world, such as in Africa, Darfur, and Sudan, and so forth, it might be subsumed under the heading of triage, that we can't do much about it, and we're not willing to do much about it. But going back to some more local things, reasons that might be beyond our control, well, I'm thinking of... The injustices that have occurred, and we say, why do they occur, and why are these rules, codes, laws, and conduct pertaining, and quite often we respond to them as a result, like Gandhi did. He sought persecution and went on to change his whole lifestyle as a lawyer and fought for the independence of the lower classes in his country. So there's a whole slew of things, and I realize time is short, but I was struck by something thought of... came upon a long time ago, the consequence of the image in our striving at that time to keep up with the Joneses or maybe do things in relation to peer groups, everybody's doing it, even to the point where Enron and other companies are now affected, to the point of saying, well, we didn't think this was wrong, and we went ahead and do it, and did it. So I just thought I'd throw a slew of things, and I thank you for your broad observation and wisdom and insight, and I'm certainly going to get your book.
No, you're making a very important point, and that is that reasons often carry with them justifications. That is, I ask you why you did something. I'm not just looking for a technical account. I'm not even looking just for a causal account of what you did. At the same time, I'm looking for a justification. And that means that I'm searching your reasons, saying, wait a minute, that won't wash. He felt like it in these circumstances won't do because he had a responsibility to do something else.
We are at the point, I'm sorry to say, we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. We have another caller we can't take, my apologies. But anyone can go and look at the book and read more in the subject that we've been talking about here. The book is titled Why? What Happens When People Give Reasons and Why? It is published by the Princeton University Press by our guest, Charles Tilley. He's professor of social science at Columbia University. And Professor Tilley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The broadcast today is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign, offering guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of all sizes made of pure wool or silk pile. Since 1992, Eastern Rug Gallery has provided cleaning, repair, and restoration of handmade rugs. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. That's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There is much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. And the host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, a veterinarian will join us. So your questions for veterinarian Julia Whittington about wildlife medicine, about our companion animals, all will be welcome this afternoon.